Today's Global IQ with Jim Falk is with Nick Kristof, who is certainly well-known and admired by World Affairs Council members across the network, a two-time Pulitzer Prize winner and columnist for the New York Times. Nick and his wife, Cheryl Woudun, are authors of several books, and most recently, A Path Appears, Transforming Lives, Creating Opportunities, which is now available in paperback. Welcome. Thanks for being with
us. Good to be with you, Jim.
The photo of Alan Kurdi, the young Syrian boy who drowned on a Turkish beach, galvanized public opinion. Yet he was but one of nearly 4,000 migrants, many of whom were children who have perished already trying to reach Europe, or the 10 million displaced refugees. What was the difference?
You know, I think it was a reminder that foreign policy, and for that matter, domestic policy, often are moved not by powerful arguments as such, but by emotions. And there was nothing new about Alan Kurdi, but that image was gut-wrenching. And the power of that to make people uncomfortable with the policy towards Syrian refugees was, you know, a profound reminder that often the central arguments that sway people and change history are about images, about video, about emotions.
It's very hard to look into a crystal ball, but just today or yesterday, Germany announced some changes. What do you think is going to happen?
Well, I mean, the European approach is unsustainable. And I so admire Angela Merkel for showing real moral leadership in welcoming refugees, and, you know, more power to her. But Germany cannot accommodate 800,000 refugees. And the downside of that humanitarian welcome is that word is now spreading in refugee camps that if you can get to Europe, Germany's going to welcome you. And there is some risk that the result is going to be new waves of migration and perhaps more Alan Kurdis perishing at sea in the effort to get to Germany. So we need a humanitarian welcome, but above all, we have to make Syria habitable again. We have to address the conditions around the world that are driving people away.
You know, it's a little bit what happened in Texas last summer with the Central Americans. So many came.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. And, you know, that's a reminder that you ultimately have to address the forces in other countries that are propelling people away. I mean, we ended up solving the Mexican immigration problems in large part because Mexico got richer. And so Mexico is by and large a transit country now, but it's not a source country for net migration for the most part. And, you know, if that can be an impetus for us to address some of the terrible governance problems in Central America and for Germany to address the catastrophe of what is unfolding right now in Syria, then that would be a plus.
What about the fact, though, that the UAE and Saudi Arabia are really unwilling, one, to take any refugees or really provide any financial support, say, to countries that are? Do they not have a moral obligation?
They absolutely do. And I think they I tried to embarrass the Saudis in my column over this. I hope others will do so. I mean, it's true that they are indeed taking a lot of Syrians on work visas, but not giving them refugee status. And they're not doing nearly enough to support Syrian refugees in the surrounding countries, in Lebanon, in Jordan, in Turkey. You know, the way to solve this refugee crisis fundamentally is to address the problem within Syria as best we can.
But that's been going on for 4 years.
Yes.
What's your prescription?
My prescription, and I think I don't know if this would work, and I think it's less likely today than it would have been a few years ago. I think that President Obama's passivity has made it harder to solve now than it would have been a few years ago. But my prescription would be to aim toward some kind of a peace deal that would probably result in a fragmentation of Syria, and it might leave remnants of the Assad regime in place, but not Assad himself. And how do you get there? I think that one thing that would give us leverage is a no-fly zone in the south. And the advantage of that is partly to stop the barrel bombs that are killing people. But beyond that, if you have a no-fly zone administered from the Mediterranean with missiles, the naval missiles, that it's fairly cheap to do, and it neutralizes the Assad regime. It puts pressure on them, and I think it makes it more likely that the regime and that its backers in Moscow and Tehran will agree to some kind of a peace deal.
You know, we hear so much about how China is now beginning to make great inroads into Africa, Middle East, etc. Do you believe that our foreign assistance aid should be tied to a country's human rights records? I'm struck just recently seeing that we're still providing in excess of, I think, $1.3 billion to Egypt, and yet the human rights records of el-Sisi is certainly one that is deteriorating.
I don't have a sort of theological answer to that. I think that there are times and places where there is a humanitarian crisis where you have to provide aid, even though the regime is despicable. And there are other cases where, Ethiopia is an interesting case where you have a repressive regime, and yet it has been doing quite well in health and agriculture and improving the livelihoods of people. And I struggle with that one, but I'm sympathetic to the argument that if we can save lives inexpensively in Ethiopia, notwithstanding the government, then, you know, we should speak up more about its abuses, but we should continue to provide that aid. Mm-hmm. But when you look at Egypt, A, I don't think we're getting any bang for the buck for that assistance. I don't think we're getting leverage. And these are vast amounts of money that I think could be deployed elsewhere, and I think we're, you know, getting in bed with a regime that is, is going to tarnish our own image, just as we have done in Egypt itself and in so many other countries over the years.
You and your wife are a really inspirational catalyst, if you wish, for making people think about some very tough subjects. How do you decide what topic to address and what to write about in your column?
I look for issues that are important and affect not just, you know, one country, but that have broader significance and that are not getting enough attention. I think that journalists can be in the lighting business or in the heating business, and I like to think of myself in the lighting business. But that spotlight that I have is essentially most effective if it's shining on something that is not illuminated already, if it's in the dark. And if I think about the areas where I've maybe had the most impact in my column, it's been issues like Darfur or sex trafficking or obstetric fistula that, you know, that where I was not exactly jostling other journalists.
Paul Krugman is not looking to write about that.
And I think that that is where we can really have. I don't think that our power comes in persuading people about issues they've thought about. I think it comes from our role in projecting issues onto the agenda and making people sometimes uncomfortable, make them spill their coffee in the morning, but make them face up to issues.
You do a good job at it. We have time for just one more question. I want to ask you to talk a bit about this wonderful book, A Path Appears. We're now increasingly aware of the staggering economic inequality in the United States, and indeed, unfortunately, Dallas is a striking example. Share with us what you've discovered in researching your book, and what may we do as individuals to help create opportunities for those who are disadvantaged?
You know, I think, Jim, the word you used, opportunity, I think that's where one can focus on, and that this is an area that tends to be highly polarized. A lot of the solutions provoke tremendous disagreement. I think there is some avenue to build, to focus on opportunity. It's one area the left and right to some degree agree on. And one of the lessons I think of the research of the last 20 years is the importance of focusing on early childhood to create opportunity. You know, when 25% of black kids in the inner city suffer lead poisoning, then, you know, by age two, they're already hugely behind. When kids don't, when they've heard 30 million fewer words by age four, they're starting preschool behind. And we have a bunch of interventions that are in many cases cheap, that involve early exposure to literacy, coaching parents on hugging their kids more, speaking to their kids more, avoiding lead exposures, that are really pretty cheap and that dramatically reduce things like juvenile delinquency later on, spending on prisons later on. If you don't invest in the front end, you end up paying at the back end. And I think that there just maybe is some room to build bipartisan coalitions, bleeding heart liberals, bleeding heart conservatives, and to invest in children.
Well, let's hope that works. My guest today has been Nick Kristof, author of Remember, A Path Appears. It's now available in paperback. And how can we follow and get on your blog?
So what I would so by all means follow me on Facebook, follow me on Twitter, but also I've started a newsletter that I recommend that links to my blog and also gives free access to all my columns without hitting the New York Times paywall. If you go to any one of my columns, then on the left-hand side there's a sign up to get this email, and it's free, and I sure recommend it.
Well, I subscribed about 3 or 4 months ago and I've really enjoyed it, so thank you. Let me remind everyone to learn more about a World Affairs Council near you, just go to worldaffairscouncils.org. Thanks again, Nick Kristof.
My pleasure.